that this incident should have been reported to either police or social work seem not to have occurred to Izzy, or indeed her father. It was as though Jacko Kent and his son were wild creatures in the wood, behaving regrettably as such animals naturally behaved.
"I think the less said about Jacko Kent," said Torquil, "the better. And you say Jimmy had reason to wish your father harm, Fizz, but what he really wanted was money, and killing your father certainly wasn't going to—"
"He was angry with Papa, though," said Fizzy determinedly. "Maybe when he realized Papa wasn't going to pay up, he saw red. He was a holy terror when he was a teenager," she told Strike. "Got into far-left politics early. He used to be down in the local pub with the Butcher Brothers, telling everybody that Tories should be hung, drawn and quartered, trying to sell people the socialist worker." Fizzy glanced sideways at her sister, who, rather determinedly, Strike thought, ignored her. "He was trouble, always trouble," Fizzy said. "The girls liked him, but—" The drawing-room door opened, and to the rest of the family's evident surprise, Kinvara strode in, flushed and agitated. After a little difficulty extricating himself from his sagging armchair, Strike succeeded in standing up and held out a hand.
"Cormorant Strike, how do you do?"
Kinvara looked as though she would have liked to ignore his friendly overture, but shook the offered hand with bad grace. Torquil pulled up another chair beside the ottoman, and Fizzy poured an extra cup of tea.
"Horse is all right, Kinvara?"
Torquil asked heartily.
"Well, Mystic's taken another chunk out of Romano," she said with a nasty glance at Robin. "So I've had to call the vet again. He gets upset every time somebody comes up the drive too fast. Otherwise, he's absolutely fine."
"I don't know why you put the stallions in together, Kinvara," said Fizzy.
"It's a myth that they don't get along," Kinvara snapped back. "Bachelor herds are perfectly common in the wild. There was a study in Switzerland that proved they can coexist peacefully once they've established a hierarchy amongst themselves."
She spoke in dogmatic, almost fanatic tones.
"We were just telling Cormoran about Jimmy Knight," Fizzy told Kinvara.
"I thought you didn't want to go into—"
"Not the blackmail," said Torquil hastily, "but what a horror he was when he was younger."
"Oh," said Kinvara, "I see."
"Your stepdaughter's worried that he may have had something to do with your husband's death," said Strike, watching her for a reaction.
"I know," said Kinvara, with apparent indifference, her eyes following Raphael, who had just walked away from the grate to fetch a pack of Marlborough lights that lay beside a table lamp. "I never knew Jimmy Knight. The first time I ever laid eyes on him was when he turned up at the house a year ago to speak to Jasper. There's an ashtray beneath that magazine, Raphael."
Her stepson lit his cigarette and returned carrying the ashtray, which he placed on a table beside Robin, before resuming his position in front of the empty fireplace.
"That was the start of it," Kinvara continued. "The blackmail. Jasper wasn't actually there that night, so Jimmy talked to me. Jasper was furious when he came home and I told him."
Strike waited. He suspected that he wasn't the only one in the room who thought Kinvara might break the family vow of omerta and blurt out what Jimmy had come to say. She refrained, however, so Strike drew out his notebook.
"Would you mind if I run through a few routine questions? I doubt there'll be anything you haven't already been asked by the police. Just a couple of points I'd like clarified, if you don't mind. How many keys are there to the house in Ebury Street?"
"Three, as far as I'm aware," said Kinvara.
The emphasis suggested that the rest of the family might have been hiding keys from her.
"And who had them?" asked Strike.
"Well, Jasper had his own," she said, "and I had one, and there was a spare that Jasper had given to the cleaning woman."
"What's her name?"
"I have no idea. Jasper let it go a couple of weeks before he died."
"Why did he sack her?" asked Strike.
"Well, if you must know, he got rid of her because we were tightening our belts."
"Had she come from an agency?"
"Oh, no, Jasper was old-fashioned. He put a card up in a local shop, and she applied. I think she was Romanian or Polish or something."
"Have you got her details?"
"No, Jasper hired and fired her. I never even met her."
What happened to her key?
It was in the kitchen drawer at Ebury Street, but after he died, we found out that Jasper had removed it and locked it up in his desk at work, said Kinvara. It was handed back by the ministry with all his other personal effects.
That seems odd, Strike said. Anyone know why he'd have done that?
The rest of the family looked blank, but Kinvara said, He was always security conscious, and he'd been paranoid lately, except when it came to the horses, of course. All the keys to Ebury Street are a special kind, restricted, impossible to copy.
Tricky to copy, said Strike, making a note. But not impossible, if you know the right people. Where were the other two keys at the time of death?
Jasper's was in his jacket pocket and mine was here, in my handbag, said Kinvara.
The canister of helium, said Strike, moving on. Does anybody know when it was purchased?
Total silence greeted these words.
Was there ever a party? Strike asked. Perhaps for one of the children.
Never, said Fizzy. Ebury Street was the place Papa used for work. He never hosted a party there that I can remember.
You, Mrs. Chisel, Strike asked Kinvara, can you remember any occasion?
No, she said, cutting across him. I've already told the police this. Jasper must have bought it himself. There's no other explanation.
Has a receipt been found? A credit card bill? He probably paid cash, said Torquil helpfully. Another thing I'd like to clear up, Strike said, working down the list he had made himself, is this business of the phone calls the minister made on the morning of his death. Apparently he called you, Mrs. Chisel, and then you, Raphael.
Raphael nodded. Kinvara said, He wanted to know whether I meant it when I said I was leaving, and I said yes, I did. It wasn't a long conversation. I didn't know who your assistant really was. She appeared out of nowhere, and Jasper was odd in his manner when I asked about her, and I was very upset. I thought there was something going on.
Were you surprised that your husband waited until the morning to call you about the note you left? Asked Strike.
He told me he hadn't spotted it when he came in.
Where had you left it?
On his bedside table. He was probably drunk when he got back. He was drinking heavily. Ever since the blackmail business started.
The Norfolk Terrier that had been shut out of the house suddenly popped up at one of the long windows and began barking at them again.
Bloody dog, said Torquil.
He misses Jasper, said Kinvara. He was Jasper's dog.
She stood up abruptly and walked away to snatch some tissues from a box sitting on top of the gardening books. Everybody looked uncomfortable. The terrier barked on and on. The sleeping Labrador woke and let out a single deep bark in return before one of the tow-headed children reappeared on the lawn, shouting for the Norfolk Terrier to come and play ball. It bounded off again.
"Good boy, Pringle!"
shouted Torquil. In the absence of barking, Kinvara's small gulps and the sounds of the Labrador flopping down to sleep again filled the room. Izzy, Fizzy and Torquil exchanged awkward glances, while Raphael stared rather stonily ahead. Little though she liked Kinvara, Robin found the family's inaction unfeeling.
"Where did that picture come from?"
asked Torquil, with an artificial air of interest, squinting at the equine painting over Raphael's head.
"New, isn't it?"
"That was one of Tinky's," said Fizzy, squinting up at it. "She brought a bunch of horsey junk over from Ireland with her."
"See that foal?" said Torquil, staring critically at the picture. "You know what it looks like? Lethal white syndrome. Heard of it?" he asked his wife and sister-in-law. "You all know all about that, Kinvara," he said,
clearly under the impression that he was graciously offering a way back into polite conversation.
"Pure white foal seems healthier when it's born, but defective bowel. Can't pass feces. My father bred horses," he explained to Strike. "They can't survive lethal whites. The tragedy is that they're born alive. So the mare feeds them, gets attached, and then talks," said Fizzy tensely.
But it was too late. Kinvara blundered out of the room. The door slammed.
What? Said Torquil, surprised. What have I...
Baby, whispered Fizzy.
Oh, Lord, he said. I clean forgot.
He got to his feet, hitched up his mustard corduroys, embarrassed and defensive.
Oh, come on, he said to the room at large. I couldn't expect her to take it that way. Horses in a bloody painting.
You know what it's like, said Fizzy, about anything connected with birth. Sorry, she said to Strike and Robin. She had a baby that didn't survive, you see. Very sensitive on the subject.
Torquil approached the painting and squinted over Raphael's head at words etched on a small plaque set into the frame.
Mare Mourning, he read. There you are, you see, he said, with an air of triumph. Foal is dead.
Kinvara likes it, said Raphael unexpectedly, because the mare reminds her of Lady.
Who? Said Torquil.
The mare that got laminitis.
What's laminitis?
Asked Strike. A disease of the hoof, Robin told him.
Oh, do you ride?
Asked Fizzy keenly.
I used to.
Laminitis is serious, Fizzy told Strike. It can cripple them. They need a lot of care, and sometimes nothing can be done, so it's kindness.
My stepmother had been nursing this mare for weeks, Raphael told Strike. Getting up in the middle of the night and so on. My father waited.
Raph, this really hasn't got anything to do with anything, said Izzy.
Waited, continued Raphael doggedly, until Kinvara went out one day, called in the vet without telling her, and had the horse put down.
Lady was suffering, said Izzy. Papa told me what a state she was in. It was pure selfishness keeping her alive.
Yeah, well, said Raphael, his eyes on the lawn beyond the windows. If I'd gone out and come back to the corpse of an animal I loved, I might have reached for the nearest blunt instrument as well.
Raph, said Izzy, please.
You're the one who wanted this, Izzy, he said, with grim satisfaction. Do you really think Mr. Strike and his glamorous assistant aren't going to find Tegan and talk to her? They'll soon know what a shit Dad could...
Raph,
said Fizzy sharply.
Steady on, old chap, said Torquil.
Something that Robin had never thought to hear outside a book. This whole thing's been bloody upsetting, but there's no need for that. Ignoring all of them, Raphael turned back to Strike.
I suppose your next question was going to be, what did my father say to me when he called me that morning?
That's right, said Strike.
He ordered me down here, said Raphael.
Here? Repeated Strike.
Woolston?
Here,
said Raphael. This house. He told me he thought Kinvara was going to do something stupid. He sounded woolly, a bit odd, like he had a heavy hangover.
What did you understand by something stupid? Asked Strike,
his pen poised over his pad.
Well, she's got form at threatening to top herself, said Raph. So that, I suppose. Or he might have been afraid she was going to torch what little he had left.
He gestured around the shabby room.
As you can see, that wasn't much.
Did he tell you she was leaving him?
I got the impression that things were bad between them, but I can't remember his exact words. He wasn't very coherent.
Did you do as he asked? Asked Strike.
Yep, said Raphael. Got in my car like an obedient son, drove all the way here, and found Kinvara alive and well in the kitchen, raging about Venetia. Robin, I mean. He corrected himself. As you may have gathered, Kinvara thought Dad was fucking her.
Raph, said Fizzy, sounding outraged. There's no need, said Torquil, for that kind of language.
Everybody was carefully avoiding catching Robin's eye. She knew she had turned red.
Seems odd, doesn't it? Strike asked. Your father asking you to come all the way down to Oxfordshire, when there were people far closer he could have asked to keep an eye on his wife. Didn't I hear that there was someone here overnight?
Izzy piped up before Raphael could answer.
Tegan was here that night, the stable girl, because Kinvara won't leave the horses without a sitter, she said.
And then, correctly anticipating Strike's next question,
I'm afraid nobody's got any contact details for her, because Kinvara had a row with her right after Papa died and Tegan walked out. I don't actually know where she's working now. Don't forget, though, said Izzy, leaning forwards and addressing Strike earnestly. Tegan was probably fast asleep when Kinvara claimed she came back here. This is a big house. Kinvara could have claimed to have come back any time, and Tegan might not have known.
If Kinvara was there with him in Ebury Street, why would he tell me to come and find her here? Raphael asked, exasperated. And how do you explain how she got here ahead of me?
Izzy looked as though she would like to make a good retort to this, but appeared unable to think of one.
Strike knew now why Izzy had said that the content of Chisel's phone call to his son didn't matter. It further undermined the case for Kinvara as murderer.
"What's Tegan's surname?" he asked.
"Butcher," said Izzy.
"Any relation to the Butcher brothers Jimmy Knight used to hang around with?" Strike asked.
Robin thought the three on the sofa seemed to be avoiding each other's eyes. Fizzy then answered,
"Yes, as a matter of fact, but I suppose I could try and contact the family, see whether they'll give me Tegan's number," said Izzy. "Yes, I'll do that, Cormoran, and let you know how I get on."
Strike turned back to Raphael.
"So, did you set off immediately after your father asked you to go to Kinvara?"
"No, I ate something first and showered," said Raphael. "I wasn't exactly looking forward to dealing with her. She and I aren't each other's favourite people. I got here around 9.
"How long did you stay?"
"Well, in the end I was here for hours," said Raphael quietly. "A couple of police arrived to break the news that Dad was dead. I could hardly walk out after that, could I? Kinvara nearly
The door reopened, and Kinvara walked back in, returned to her hard-backed chair, her face set, tissues clutched in her hand.
"I've only got 5 minutes," she said. "The vet's just called. He's in the area, so he'll pop in to see Romano. I can't stay."
"Could I ask something?" Robin asked Strike. "I know it might be nothing at all," she said to the room at large. "But there was a small blue tube of homeopathic pills on the floor beside the minister when I found him. Homeopathy didn't seem to be the kind of thing he'd..."
"What kind of pills?" asked Kinvara sharply, to Robin's surprise.
"Lachesis," said Robin.
"In a small blue tube?"
"Yes. Were they yours?"
"Yes, they were."
"You left them in Ebury Street?" asked Strike.
"No, I lost them weeks ago. But I never had them there," she said, frowning more to herself than to the room. "I bought them in London because the pharmacy in Woolston didn't have any."
She frowned, clearly reconstructing events in her mind.
"I remember I tasted a couple outside the chemist's because I wanted to know whether he'd noticed them in his feed."
"Sorry, what?" asked Robin, unsure she had heard correctly.
"Mystic's feed," said Kinvara. "I was going to give them to Mystic."
"You were going to give homeopathic tablets to a horse," said Torquil, inviting everyone else to agree that this was funny.
"Jasper thought it was a ludicrous idea too," said Kinvara vaguely, still lost in recollection. "Yes, I opened them up right after I'd paid for them, took a couple, and," she mimed the action, "put the tube in my jacket pocket, but when I got home, they weren't there any more. I thought I must have dropped them somehow."
Then she gave a little gasp and turned red. She seemed to be boggling at some inner private realization. Then, realizing that everybody was still watching her, she said,
"I travelled home from London with Jasper that day. We met at the station, got the train together. He took them out of my pocket. He stole them, so I couldn't give them to Mystic."
"Kinvara, don't be so utterly ridiculous," said Fizzy, with a short laugh. Raphael suddenly ground out his cigarette in the china ashtray at Robin's elbow. He seemed to be refraining from comment with difficulty.
"Did you buy more?"
Robin asked Kinvara.
"Yes,"
said Kinvara, who seemed almost disorientated with shock, though Robin thought her conclusion as to what had happened to her pills very strange.
"They were in a different bottle, though. That blue tube, that's the one I bought first."
"Isn't homeopathy just placebo effect?" Torquil inquired of the room at large. "How could a horse talks?"
muttered Fizzy, through gritted teeth.
Shut up!
Why would your husband have stolen a tube of homeopathic pills from you? Asked Strike curiously. It seems pointlessly spiteful? Asked Raphael, arms folded beneath the picture of the dead foal. Because you're so convinced you're right and the other person's wrong, that it's okay to stop them doing something harmless.
Raph, said Izzy at once, I know you're upset.
I'm not upset, Iz, said Raph. Very liberating, really, going back through all the shitty things Dad did while he was alive.
That's enough, boy, said Torquil.
Don't call me boy, said Raphael, shaking another cigarette out of his packet. All right? Don't fucking call me boy.
You'll have to excuse Raph, Torquil told Strike loudly. He's upset with my late father-in-law because of the will.
I already knew I'd been written out of the will, snapped Raphael, pointing at Kinvara. She sort of that.
Your father didn't need any persuasion from me, I promise you, said Kinvara, scarlet in the face now. Anyway, you've got plenty of money. Your mother spoils you rotten.
She turned to Robin.
His mother left Jasper for a diamond merchant, after taking Jasper for everything she could lay her hands on.
Could I ask another couple of questions? Said Strike loudly, before a plainly fuming Raphael could speak.
The vet will be here for Romano in a minute, said Kinvara. I need to get back to the stable.
Just a couple and I'm done, Strike assured her.
Did you ever miss any amitriptyline pills? I think you were prescribed them, weren't you?
The police asked me this. I might have lost some, said Kinvara, with irritating vagueness. But I can't be sure. There was a box I thought I'd lost, and then I found it again, and it didn't have as many pills in as I remembered. And I know I meant to leave a pack at Ebury Street, in case I ever forgot when I was coming up from London. But when the police asked me, I couldn't remember whether I'd actually done it or not.
So you couldn't swear to it that you had pills missing?
No, said Kinvara. Jasper might have stolen some, but I can't swear to it.
Have you had any more intruders in your garden since your husband died? Asked Strike.
No, said Kinvara. Nothing.
I heard that a friend of your husband's tried to call him early the morning that he died, but couldn't get through. Do you happen to know who the friend was?
Oh, yes, it was Henry Drummond, said Kinvara.
And who's...
He's an art dealer, very old friend of Papa's, interrupted Izzy. Raphael worked for him for a little while, didn't you, Raph, until he came to help Papa at the House of Commons.
I can't see what Henry's got to do with anything, said Torquil,
with an angry little laugh.
Well, I think that's everything, said Strike, ignoring this comment as he closed his notebook. Except that I'd be glad to know whether you think your husband's death was suicide, Mrs. Chisel.
The hand grasping the tissue contracted tightly.
Nobody's interested in what I think, she said.
I assure you I am, said Strike.
Kinvara's eyes flickered from Raphael, who was scowling at the lawn outside, to Torquil.
Well, if you want my opinion, Jasper did a very stupid thing right before he...
Kinvara, said Torquil sharply. You'd be best advised...
I'm not interested in your advice, said Kinvara, turning on him suddenly, eyes narrowed. After all, it's your advice that brought this family to financial ruin.
Fizzy shot her husband a look across Izzy, warning him against retorting. Kinvara turned back to Strike.
My husband provoked somebody, I warned him he shouldn't upset, shortly before he died.
You mean Geraint Wynne? Asked Strike.
No, said Kinvara, but you're close. Torquil doesn't want me to say anything about it, because it involves his good friend Christopher.
Bloody hell! Exploded Torquil.
He got to his feet, again hitching up his mustard corduroys, and looking incensed.
My God! Are we dragging total outsiders into this fantasy now? What the bloody hell has Christopher got to do with anything? My father-in-law killed himself, he told Strike loudly, before rounding on his wife and sister-in-law. I've tolerated this nonsense because you girls want peace of mind. But frankly, if this is where it's going to lead...
Izzy and Fizzy set up an outcry, both trying to placate him and justify themselves, and in the midst of this melee, Kinvara got to her feet, tossed back her long red hair, and walked towards the door, leaving Robin with a strong impression that she had lobbed this grenade into the conversation deliberately. At the door she paused, and the others' heads turned, as though she had called to them. In her high, clear, childish voice, Kinvara said,
"You all come back here and treat this house as though you're the real owners and I'm a guest. But Jasper said I could live here as long as I'm alive. Now I need to see the vet, and when I get back, I'd like you all to have gone home. You aren't welcome here any more."
Chapter 43. I am afraid it will not be long before we hear something of the family ghost. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Robin asked whether she might use the bathroom before they departed from Chisel House, and was shown across the hall by Fizzy, who was still fuming at Kinvara. "How dare she?" said Fizzy, as they crossed the hall. "How dare she? This is Pringle's house, not hers." And in the next breath, "Please don't pay any attention to what she said about Christopher. She's simply trying to get a rise out of talks. It was a disgusting thing to do. He's simply livid." "Who is Christopher?" Robin asked.
"Well, I don't know whether I should say," replied Fizzy. "But I suppose if you... Of course, he can't have anything to do with it. It's just Kinvara's spite. She's talking about Sir Christopher Barraclough Burns. Old friend of Torx's family. Christopher's a senior civil servant, and he was that boy Malik's mentor at the Foreign Office."
The lavatory was chilly and antiquated. As she bolted the door, Robin heard Fizzy striding back to the drawing room, doubtless to placate the angry Torquil. She looked around. The chipped, painted stone walls were bare, except for many small dark holes in which the occasional nail stuck out. Robin presumed Kinvara was responsible for the removal of a large number of perspex frames from the wall, which now stood stacked on the floor facing the toilet. They contained a jumble of family photographs in messy collages. After drying her hands on a damp towel that smelled of dog, Robin crouched down to flick through these frames. Izzy and Fizzy had been almost indistinguishable as children, making it impossible to tell which of them was cartwheeling on the croquet lawn or jumping a pony at a local gymkhana, dancing in front of a Christmas tree in the hall, or embracing the young Jasper Chisel at a shooting picnic, the men all in tweeds and barbers. Freddy, however, was immediately recognizable, because unlike his sisters, he had inherited his father's protuberant lower lip. As white blonde in youth as his niece and nephews, he featured frequently, beaming for the camera as a toddler, stony-faced as a child in a new prep school uniform, muddy and triumphant in rugby kit. Robin paused to examine a group shot of teenagers, all dressed head to toe in white fencing jackets. Union Jacks ran down the sides of everyone's breeches. She recognized Freddy, who was standing in the middle of the group, holding a large silver cup. At the far end of the group was a miserable-looking girl whom Robin recognized immediately as Rhiannon Wynne, older and thinner than she had been in the photograph her father had shown Robin, her slightly cringing air at odds with the proud smiles on every other face. Continuing to search the boards, Robin stopped at the last one to examine the faded photograph of a large party. It had been taken in a marquee from what seemed to be a stage. Many bright blue helium balloons in the shape of the number 18 danced over the crowd's heads. 100 or so teenagers had clearly been bidden to face the camera. Robin scanned the scene carefully and found Freddy easily enough, surrounded by a large group of both boys and girls, whose arms were slung around each other's shoulders, beaming, and in some cases braying with laughter. After nearly a minute, Robin spotted the face she had instinctively sought. Rhiannon Wynne, thin, pale, and unsmiling beside the drinks table. Close behind her, half hidden in shadow, were a couple of boys who were not in black tie, but jeans and T-shirts. One in particular was darkly handsome and long-haired, his T-shirt bearing a picture of The Clash. Robin got out her mobile and took a picture of both the fencing team and the 18th birthday party photographs, then carefully replaced the stack of Perspex boards as she had found them and left the bathroom. She thought for a second that the silent hall was deserted. Then she saw that Raphael was leaning up against a hall table, his arms folded. "Well, goodbye," said Robin, starting to walk towards the front door. "Hang on a minute." As she paused, he pushed himself off the table and approached her. "I've been quite angry with you, you know." "I can understand why," said Robin quietly. "But I was doing what your father hired me to do." He moved closer, coming to a halt beneath an old glass lantern hanging from the ceiling. Half the light bulbs were missing. "I'd say you're bloody good at it, are you? Getting people to trust you." "That's the job," said Robin. "You're married," he said, eyes on her left hand. "Yes," she said. "To Tim?" "No, there isn't any Tim."
"You're not married to him," said Raphael quickly, pointing outside.
"No, we just work together."
"And that's your real accent," said Raphael. "Yorkshire."
"Yes," she said. "This is it." She thought he was going to say something insulting. The olive dark eyes moved over her face. Then he shook his head slightly.
"I quite like the voice, but I preferred Venetia. Made me think of masked orgies."
He turned and walked away, leaving Robin to hurry back out into the sunshine to rejoin Strike, who she presumed would be waiting impatiently in the Land Rover. She was wrong. He was still standing beside the car's bonnet, while Izzy, who was standing very close to him, talked rapidly in an undertone. When she heard Robin's feet on the gravel behind her, Izzy took a step backwards with what, to Robin, seemed a slightly guilty, embarrassed air.
"Lovely to see you again,"
Izzy said, kissing Robin on both cheeks, as though this had been a simple social call.
"And you'll ring me, won't you?"
she said to Strike.
"Yes, I'll keep you updated," he said, moving around to the passenger seat.
Neither Strike nor Robin spoke as she turned the car around. Izzy waved them off, a slightly pathetic figure in her loose shirt dress. Strike raised a hand to her as they took the bend in the drive that hid her from their sight. Trying not to upset the skittish stallions, Robin drove at a snail's pace. Glancing left, Strike saw that the injured horse had been removed from the field, but in spite of Robin's best intentions, as the noisy old car lurched past its field, the black stallion took off again.
"Who do you reckon?" said Strike, watching the horse plunge and buck. "First took a look at something like that and thought, I should get on its back."
"There's an old saying," said Robin, trying to steer around the worst of the potholes. "The horse is your mirror. People say dogs resemble their owners, but I think it's truer of horses."
"Making Kimvara highly strong and prone to lash out on slight provocation. Sounds about right. Turn right here. I want to get a look at Stedder Cottage."
A bare 2 minutes later, he said,
"Here, go up here."
The track to Stedder Cottage was so overgrown that Robin had missed it entirely the first time they had passed it. It led deep into the woodland that lay hard up against the gardens of Chisel House, but unfortunately, the Land Rover was only able to proceed for 10 yards before the track became impassable by car. Robin cut the engine, privately worried about how Strike was going to manage a barely discernible path of earth and fallen leaves, overgrown with brambles and nettles, but as he was already getting out, she followed suit, slamming the driver's door behind her. The ground was slippery, the tree canopy so dense that the track was in deep shade, dank and moist. A pungent, green, bitter smell filled their nostrils, and the air was alive with the rustle of birds and small creatures whose habitat was being rudely invaded.
"So," said Strike, as they struggled through the bushes and weeds, "Christopher Barraclough Burns, that's a new name."
"No, it isn't," said Robin. Strike looked sideways at her, grinning, and immediately tripped on a root, remaining upright at some cost to his sore knee.
Shit. I wondered whether you remembered.
Christopher didn't promise anything about the pictures, quoted Robin promptly. He's a civil servant who mentored Amir Malik at the Foreign Office. Fizzy just told me. We're back to a man of your habits, aren't we? Neither spoke for a short spell as they concentrated on a particularly treacherous stretch of path where whip-like branches clung willingly to fabric and skin. Robin's skin was a pale, dapple green in the sun, filtered by the ceiling of leaves above them.
See any more of Raphael after I went outside?
Yes, actually, said Robin, feeling slightly self-conscious. He came out of the sitting room as I was coming out of the loo.
Didn't think he'd pass up another chance of talking to you, said Strike.
It wasn't like that, Robin said untruthfully, remembering the remark about masked orgies. Is he whispering anything interesting back there? She asked. Amused by the reciprocal jab, Strike took his eyes off the path, thereby failing to spot a muddy stump. He tripped for a second time, this time saving himself from a painful fall by grabbing a tree covered in a prickly climbing plant.
Fuck!
Are you...
I'm fine, he said, angry with himself, examining the palm that was now full of thorns and starting to pull them out with his teeth.
He heard a loud snap of wood behind him and turned to see Robin holding out a fallen branch, which she had broken to make a rough walking stick. Use this.
I don't, he began,
but catching sight of her stern expression, he gave in.
Thanks.
They set off again, Strike finding the stick more useful than he wanted to admit.
Izzy was just trying to convince me that Kinvara could have sneaked back to Oxfordshire after bumping off Chisel between 6 and 7 in the morning. I don't know whether she realizes there are multiple witnesses to every stage of Kinvara's journey from Ebury Street. The police probably haven't gone into detail with the family yet, but I think, once the penny drops that Kinvara can't have done it in person, Izzy'll start suggesting she hired a hitman. What did you make of Raphael's various outbursts?
Well, said Robin, navigating around a patch of nettles, I can't blame him, getting annoyed with Torquil.
No, agreed Strike. I think old Torx would grate on me, too.
Raphael seems really angry with his father, doesn't he? He didn't have to tell us about Chisel putting that mare down. I thought he was almost going out of his way to paint his father as, well...
A bit of a shit, agreed Strike. He thought Chisel had stolen those pills of Kinvara's out of malice, too. That whole episode was bloody strange, actually. What made you so interested in those pills?
They seem so out of place for Chisel.
Well, it was a good call. Nobody else seems to have asked questions about them. So what does the psychologist make of Raphael denigrating his dead father?
Robin shook her head, smiling, as she usually did when Strike referred to her in this way. She had dropped out of her psychology course at university, as he well knew.
I'm serious, said Strike, grimacing as his false foot skidded on fallen leaves,
and he saved himself, this time with the aid of Robin's stick.
Bollocks!
Go on. What did you make of him putting the boot into Chisel? Well, I think he's hurt and furious, said Robin, weighing her words. He and his father were getting on better than they ever had, from what he told me when I was at the House of Commons. But now Chisel's dead, Raphael's never going to be able to get properly back on good terms with him, is he? He's left with the fact he was written out of the will and no idea of how Chisel really felt about him. Chisel was quite inconsistent with Raphael. When he was drunk and depressed, he seemed to lean on him, but otherwise he was pretty rude to him. Although I can't honestly say I saw Chisel ever being nice to anybody, except maybe... She stopped short.
Go on, said Strike.
Well, actually, said Robin, I was going to say he was quite nice to me, the day I found out all about the level playing field.
This was when he offered you a job?
Yes.
and he said he might have a bit more work for me once I'd got rid of Wynne and Knight.
Did he? Said Strike curiously. You never told me that.
Didn't I? No. I don't suppose I did.
And like Strike, she remembered the week that he had been laid up at Lorelei's, followed by the hours at the hospital with Jack. I went over to his office, as I told you, and he was on the phone to some hotel about a money clip he'd lost. It was Freddy's. After Chisel got off the phone, I told him about the level playing field, and he was happier than I ever saw him. One by one they tripped themselves up, he said.
Interesting, panted Strike, whose leg was now killing him. So you think Raphael's smarting about the will, do you?
Robin, who thought she caught a sardonic note in Strike's voice, said, It isn't just money.
People always say that, he grunted. It is the money, and it isn't. Because what is money? Freedom, security, pleasure, a fresh chance? I think there is more to be got out of Raphael, said Strike. And I think you're going to have to be the one to do it.
What else can he tell us?
I'd like a bit more clarity on that phone call Chisel made to him, right before that bag went over his head, panted Strike, who was now in considerable pain. It doesn't make much sense to me, because even if Chisel knew he was about to kill himself, there were people far better placed to keep Kinvara company than a stepson she didn't like who was miles away in London. Trouble is, the call makes even less sense if it was murder.
There's something, said Strike. We aren't being...
thank Christ.
Stedder Cottage had just come into view, in the clearing ahead of them. The garden, which was surrounded by a broken-down fence, was now almost as overgrown as its surroundings. The building was squat, made of dark stone and clearly derelict, with a yawning hole in the roof, and cracks in most of the windows. Sit down, Robin advised Strike, pointing him towards a large tree stump just outside the cottage fence. In too much pain to argue, he did as she instructed, while Robin picked her way towards the front door and gave it a little push, but found it locked. Wading through knee-length grass, she peered one by one through the grimy windows. The rooms were thick with dust and empty. The only sign of any previous occupant was in the kitchen, where a filthy mug bearing a picture of Johnny Cash sat alone on a stained surface. "Doesn't look as though anyone's lived here for years, and no sign of anyone sleeping rough," she informed Strike, emerging from the other side of the cottage. Strike, who had just lit a cigarette, made no answer. He was staring down into a large hollow in the woodland floor, around 20 feet square, bordered with trees and full of nettles, tangled thorn, and towering weeds.
"Would you call that a dell?" he asked her.
Robin peered down into the basin-like indentation.
"I'd say it's more like a dell than anything else we've passed," she said. "He strangled the kid and they buried it, down in the dell by our dad's house," quoted Strike.
"I'll have a look," said Robin. "You stay here."
"No," said Strike, raising a hand to stop her. "You're not going to find anything."
But Robin was already sliding her way down the steep edges of the dell, the thorns snagging at her jeans as she descended. It was extremely difficult to move around once she reached the bottom. Nettles came up almost to her waist, and she held up her hands to avoid scratches and stings. Milk parsley and wood avens speckled the dark green with white and yellow. The long thorny branches of wild roses curled like barbed wire everywhere she trod.
"Watch yourself," said Strike,
feeling impotent as he watched her struggle along, scratching or stinging herself at every other step.
"I'm fine,"
said Robin, peering at the ground beneath the wild vegetation. If anything had been buried here, it had long since been covered by plants, and digging would be a very difficult business. She said as much to Strike as she bent low to see what lay underneath a dense patch of bramble.
Doubt Kinvara would be happy with us digging anyway, said Strike.
And as he said it, he remembered Billy's words.
She wouldn't let me dig, but she'd let you.
Wait, said Robin, sounding tense. In spite of the fact that he knew perfectly well she could not have found anything, Strike tensed.
What?
There's something in there, said Robin, moving her head from side to side, the better to see into a thick patch of nettles right in the centre of the dell.
Oh, God.
What?
Strike repeated. Although far higher up than her, he could make out nothing whatsoever in the nettle patch.
What can you see?
I don't know. I might be imagining it. She hesitated. You haven't got gloves, I suppose?
No. Robin, don't—
But she had already walked into the patch of nettles, her hands raised, stamping them down at the base wherever she could, flattening them as much as possible. Strike saw her bend over and pull something out of the ground. Straightening up, she stood quite still, her red-gold head bowed over whatever she had found, until Strike said impatiently,
"What is it?"
Her hair fell away from a face that looked pale against the morass of dark green in which she stood, as she held up a small wooden cross.
"No, stay there,"
she ordered him, as he moved automatically towards the edge of the dell to help her climb out. "I'm fine." She was, in fact, covered in scratches and nettle stings, but deciding that a few more would hardly count, Robin pushed her way more forcefully out of the dell, using her hands to pull herself up the steep sides, until she came close enough for Strike to reach out a hand and help her the last few feet.
"Thanks," she said breathlessly. "Looks like it's been there years," she said,
rubbing earth from the bottom, which was pointed, the better to stick into the ground. The wood was damp and stained.
"Something was written on it," said Strike, taking it from her and squinting at the slimy surface.
"Where?"
said Robin. Her hair grazed his cheek as they stood close beside each other, staring at the very faint residue of what looked like felt tip, long since washed away by rain and dew.
"That looks like a kid's writing," said Robin quietly.
"That's an S," said Strike. "And at the end, is that a G or a Y?"
"I don't know," whispered Robin.
They stood in silence, contemplating the cross, until the faint, echoing barks of Rattenby the Norfolk Terrier pierced their reverie. "We're still on Kimbara's property," said Robin nervously.
"Yeah," said Strike, keeping hold of the cross as he began to lumber back the way they had come, teeth gritted against the pain in his leg. "Let's find a pub. I'm starving."
Chapter 44. "But there are so many sorts of white horses in this world, Mrs. Helseth." Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. "Of course," said Robin, as they drove towards the village. "A cross sticking out of the ground doesn't mean there's anything buried beneath it."
"True," said Strike, who had needed most of his breath on the return walk for the frequent obscenities he uttered as he stumbled and skidded on the forest floor. "But it makes you think, doesn't it?"
Robin said nothing. Her hands on the steering wheel were covered in nettle stings that prickled and burned. The country inn they reached 5 minutes later was the very image of picture postcard England, a white timbered building with leaded bay windows, moss-covered slates on the roof, and climbing red roses around the door. A beer garden with parasols completed the picture. Robin turned the Land Rover into the small car park opposite.
"This is getting stupid," muttered Strike,
who had left the cross on the dashboard and was now climbing out of the car, staring at the pub.
"What is?" asked Robin, coming around the back of the car to join him.
"It's called the White Horse."
"After the one up the hill,"
said Robin, as they set off across the road together. "Look at the sign." Painted on the board atop a wooden pole was the strange chalk figure they had seen earlier.
"The pub where I met Jimmy Knight the first time was called the White Horse, too," said Strike.
"The White Horse,"
said Robin. As they walked up the steps into the beer garden, Strike's limp, now more pronounced than ever, is one of the 10 most popular pub names in Britain. I read it in some article. Quick, those people are leaving. Grab their table. I'll get the drinks. The low-ceilinged pub was busy inside. Robin headed first for the ladies, where she stripped off her jacket, tied it around her waist, and washed her smarting hands. She wished that she had managed to find dock leaves on the journey back from Stedder Cottage, but most of her attention on the return walk had been given to Strike, who had nearly fallen twice more, and hobbled on looking furious with himself, repelling offers of assistance with bad grace, and leaning heavily on the walking stick she had fashioned from a branch. The mirror showed Robin that she was dishevelled and grubby compared to the prosperous middle-aged people she had just seen in the bar, but being in a hurry to return to Strike and review the morning's activities, she merely dragged a brush through her hair, wiped a green stain off her neck, and returned to queue for drinks.
"Cheers, Robin," said Strike gratefully, when she returned to him with a pint of Arkell's Wiltshire Gold, shoving the menu across the table to her. "Ah, that's good," he sighed, taking a swig. "So what's the most popular one?"
"Sorry?"
"The most popular pub name. You said the White Horse is in the top 10.
"Oh, right. It's either the Red Lion or the Crown. I can't remember which."
"The Victory's my real local," said Strike, reminiscently.
He had not been back to Cornwall in 2 years. He saw the pub now in his mind's eye, a squat building of whitewashed Cornish stone, the steps beside it winding down to the bay. It was the pub in which he had first managed to get served without ID, 16 years old, and dumped back at his uncle and aunt's for a few weeks, while his mother's life went through one of its regular bouts of upheaval.
"Ours is the Bay Horse," said Robin. And she too had a sudden vision of a pub from what she would always think of as home, also white, standing on a street that led off the market square in Masham. It was there that she had celebrated her A-level results with her friends, the same night that Matthew and she had got into a stupid row, and he had left, and she had refused to follow, but remained with her friends.
"Why Bay?" asked Strike, now halfway down his pint, and luxuriating in the sunshine, his sore leg stretched out in front of him. "Why not just Brown?"
"Well, there are brown horses," said Robin, "but Bay means something different. Black points, legs, mane, and tail."
"What colour was your pony? Angus, wasn't it?"
"How did you remember that?" asked Robin, surprised.
"Dunno," said Strike. "Same as you remembering pub names. Some things stick, don't they?"
"He was grey."
"Meaning white. It's all just jargon to confuse non-riding plebs, isn't it?"
"No," said Robin, laughing. "Grey horses have black skin under the white hairs. True whites die young," said Strike, as a barmaid arrived to take their order. Having ordered a burger, Strike lit another cigarette, and as the nicotine hit his brain, felt a wave of something close to euphoria. A pint, a hot day in August, a well-paid job, food on the way, and Robin, sitting across from him, their friendship restored, if not entirely to what it had been before her honeymoon, then perhaps as close as was possible, now that she was married. Right now, in this sunny beer garden, and in spite of the pain in his leg, his tiredness, and the unresolved mess that was his relationship with Lorelei, life felt simple and hopeful.
"Group interviews are never a good idea," he said, exhaling away from Robin's face. "But there were some interesting cross-currents among the Chisels, weren't there? I'm going to keep working on Izzy. I think she might be a bit more forthcoming without the family around."
"Izzy will like being worked on," Robin thought, as she took out her mobile.
"I've got something to show you. Look."
She brought up her photograph of Freddie Chisel's birthday party. "That," she said, pointing at the girl's pale, unhappy face, "is Rhiannon Wynne. She was at Freddie Chisel's 18th birthday party. Turns out..." She scrolled back a picture, to show the group in white tunics. They were on the British fencing team together.
"Christ, of course," said Strike, taking the phone from Robin. "The sword. The sword in Ebury Street. I bet it was Freddy's."
"Of course," echoed Robin, wondering why she hadn't realized that before.
"That can't be long before she killed herself," said Strike, scrutinizing more closely the miserable figure of Rhiannon Wynne at the birthday party. "And bloody hell, that's Jimmy Knight behind her. What's he doing at a public schoolboy's 18th?
"Free drink?" suggested Robin. Strike gave a small snort of amusement as he handed back Robin's phone.
"Sometimes the obvious answer is the right one. Was I imagining Izzy looking self-conscious when the story of Jimmy's teenage sex appeal came up?"
"No," said Robin. "I noticed that too."
"Nobody wants us to talk to Jimmy's old mates, the Butcher brothers, either. Because they know more than where their sister works."
Strike sipped his beer, thinking back to what Chisel had told him the first time they'd met.
Chisel said other people were involved in whatever he did to get blackmailed, but they had a lot to lose if it got out.
He took out his notebook and contemplated his own spiky, hard-to-read handwriting, while Robin sat peacefully, enjoying the quiet chatter of the beer garden. A lazy bee buzzed nearby, reminding her of the lavender walk at Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons, where she and Matthew had spent their anniversary. It was best not to compare how she felt now to the way she had felt then.
"Maybe," said Strike, tapping the open notebook with his pen. "The Butcher brothers agreed to take on horse-slashing duties for Jimmy while he was in London. I always thought he might have mates back down here who could have taken care of that side of things. But we'll let Izzy get Tegan's whereabouts out of them before we approach them. Don't want to upset the client unless it's absolutely necessary."
"No," agreed Robin. "I wonder, do you think Jimmy met them when he came down here looking for Billy?"
"Could well have done," said Strike, nodding over his notes. "Very interesting, that. From what they said to each other on that march, Jimmy and Flick knew where Billy was at the time. They were off to see him when my hamstring went. Now they've lost him again. You know, I'd give a hell of a lot to find Billy. That's where all of this started, and we're still..."
He broke off as their food arrived. A burger with blue cheese on it for Strike, and a bowl of chili for Robin. "We're still..." prompted Robin, as the barmaid moved away.
"None the wiser," said Strike, "about the kid he claims he saw die. I didn't want to ask the Chisels about Suki Lewis, or not yet. Best not to suggest I'm interested in anyone but Chisel's death right now."
He picked up his burger and took an enormous bite, his eyes unfocused, staring out over the road. After demolishing half of his burger, Strike turned back to his notes.
"Things to be done," he announced, picking up his pen again. "I want to find this cleaning woman Jasper Chisel laid off. She had a key for a bit, and she might be able to tell us how and when the helium got into the house. Hopefully Izzy will trace Tegan Butcher for us, and Tegan will be able to shed some light on Raphael's trip down there on the morning his father died, because I'm still not buying that story. We'll leave Tegan's brothers for now, because the Chisels clearly don't want us talking to them. But I might try and have a word with Henry Drummond, the art dealer."
"Why?" asked Robin.
"He was an old friend. Did Chisel a favour hiring Raphael. They must have been reasonably close. You never know, Chisel might have told him what the blackmail was about. And he tried to reach Chisel early on the morning Chisel died. I'd like to know why. So, going forwards, you're going to have a bash at Flick at her jewellery shop. Barclay can stay on Jimmy and Flick, and I'll tackle Geraint Wynne and Amir Malik."
"They'll never talk to you," said Robin at once.
"Never." "Wanna bet."
"Tenner says they won't."
"I don't pay you enough for you to throw tenners around," said Strike. "You can buy me a pint."
Strike took care of the bill and they headed back across the road to the car, Robin secretly wishing that there was somewhere else they needed to go, because the